Welcome to Groundwire, the national news broadcast of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association. Today's edition of Groundwire is produced at CJSF-FM at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC.
Your hosts for this edition are Tara Lansley and Frieda Worden.
We start our program with headlines. First, Catherine Fisher reports from CJLY in Nelson, BC.
Okay, no more names up there. With that set up, we'll call the question. All in favor of the motion? Contrary? Passed.
That's Kelowna Mayor Walter Gray calling the question on a matter that made national news headlines the week of August 17th. City Councillor Luke Stack brought a motion to Kelowna's August 20th council meeting requesting that the city cease to display any courtesy flags in front of Kelowna City Hall effective immediately, and council voted unanimously in favor of the motion. While it was not mentioned directly during the meeting, the decision not to display courtesy flags followed days after Kelowna's Right to Life Society mistakenly announced on its website that the city had agreed to fly their flag, which says pro-life in red lettering, during Human Life Week in September. The city stated that there was never any agreement to fly the flag. According to City Communications Supervisor Tom Wilson, only one flag has flown over City Hall during the program, and that was the rainbow flag requested by the Okanagan Rainbow Coalition, flown during Kelowna's Pride Week this year and last. Monday night's council vote to abolish the courtesy flagpole will prevent any community group from applying to fly a flag in future.
And again, that's a headline from Kelowna, BC. Next, here's Gretchen King reporting from Montreal, Quebec.
In the longest student strike in Canadian history, tens of thousands of Quebec students remain on strike. The campaign has coincided with the return to class for strikers, enforced by Law 12, which was passed by the Parti Libéral du Québec, or PLQ, before this summer. The first days of class this August saw students returning among heavy presence of riot police, and where there were protests and pickets, dozens of more were arrested, adding to the over 3,000 other arrests during this year-long of mobilization in Quebec. This has been the lead-up to an election in which the ruling PLQ has been on the defensive. A recent PLQ campaign event quickly drew a noisy protest when word spread of Jean Charest's attendance.
Lots of people have lots of problems with Jean Charest and the Liberal Party. For us, we've seen the election as an opportunity to really promote the neighborhood assemblies and say, yeah, maybe you do want to vote once every 4 or 5 years for one person to represent all the political issues for you. Or alternatively, you can show up like every 2 weeks or more to an assembly where you can have a direct say and participate in the same kind of direct democracy that's made and direct participation that's made the student strike so powerful.
That's why we're here today, to express that.
Now, did you get a chance to see Jean Charest walk in the office there?
Did. He was sort of like shoehorned in, you know, directly from the bus exit. Like, almost like they had a chute and were pushing them in, so he couldn't hear any of us bad people.
The demonstrators clearly targeted the PLQ, but we're also talking about what comes after the elections in Quebec.
The elections actually have been imposed on us to undermine our movements here. And so it's up to people in their own communities, as well as in Quebec, regardless of who the government is, to stay in the streets and to stay mobilized.
Thank you so much. Good luck today.
Thank you.
Reporting for Groundwire, this is Gretchen King from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Jean Charest has lost his seat in the Quebec election and his party lost its 9-year-long majority. The newly elected Pauline Marois from the Parti Québécois promises to cancel the tuition hike and repeal the controversial Law 12. Students are calling for another monthly demonstration on the 22nd to keep up the pressure to stop the hike.
Across Canada, the number of children in foster care is estimated at somewhere between 76,000 and 85,000. A great many of these children have been apprehended from their own families on the decision of a social worker employed by a provincial ministry of child and family development. Terence Evans believes this system is seriously overused.
It functions under the guidelines of finding that one child in 50 while destroying 100 other lives trying to protect that one child.
Evans is part of a newly formed group in British Columbia seeking reform in the child apprehension procedure. On August 28th, they converged in Victoria to speak with the opposition critic for the Ministry of Child and Family Development. There they explained how easy it is for a child to be apprehended and how complex and difficult it is even to engage with the process for getting the child back. They also complained that apprehensions take place at the discretion of a single social worker, and that this worker may not accurately report on the family, and also may not be frank with the families where they intervene.
Another thing that we've recommended to the MCFD critic is having every single interaction recorded so that the social workers can't go back on what they say. Because in so many cases, the social workers are not being held accountable for some of the things that they do. And even when caught lying, nothing happens. So we're looking for accountability, and we're looking for information for the mainstream so that it doesn't happen. Because so many lives have been destroyed by this. So many lives. So many cases. It's not right. It's not right.
The people who went to Victoria will now be forming an oversight committee that will file a report every 4 months with the Ministry of Child and Family Development critic. The critic is a member of the NDP and might be in a position to influence the ministry after the next election. Terence Evans also has an online radio show where he talks about issues of child apprehension with families from Canada and around the world. You can find it at the website thisisvancouveronline.ca.
Thanks to Frieda Worden and Dan McPeak for producing that GroundWire headline.
Moving on to news features, here's one that'll give you hope.
2012 is the 25th anniversary of the Raging Grannies, and Victoria, BC's own Raging Grannies are the founding members of this international phenomenon.
The basic philosophy of the Raging Grannies is we are extremely, extremely concerned that there be a healthy planet for all grandchildren to live on and to grow up on and to have good lives.
The first Raging Granny action was a street theater response to the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster. Dressed in lab coats and carrying makeshift Geiger counters, they tested for nuclear contamination in water puddles around the Victoria area. At that time, they called themselves NERT, the Nuclear Energy Response Team. Soon after, they emerged as the Raging Grannies. Their witty songs and theatrics reflected outrage at government inaction on nuclear issues. One such issue was the incursion of U.S. nuclear war vessels into Canadian waters.
We launched our navy in the fountain with the smallest grannies sitting in our little boat. And then we would periodically go out in our kayaks and canoes and have long-distance arguments with the U.S. sailors who eventually resorted to water hosing us, which was very bad for our boas.
Boas, bonnets, and granny gowns. These are some of the basic accessories of all the Raging Grannies public performances. Grannies discussed the value of this at a recent unconvention.
It's very important to do the equivalent of PR for the peace movement and the social justice movement by putting a friendly, humorous, non-threatening face on the issues that we are militant about.
I needed to do something. I was angry. I was upset. I was frightened after 9/11, and I found some women who had formed a Raging Granny Gaggle through my Unitarian Church. I didn't even know they dressed up in costume, which is one of my favorite things, so that was just a bonus. But I went to a rehearsal, and the rest is history.
I first saw the grannies when I was at a demonstration when Bush was coming during the last convention. All the rest of us are just standing there with their signs, you know. But there was this bunch of old ladies singing songs and having a wonderful time. And so, so they were doing the things that I was committed to do, but having a really good time doing it too. So I was very attracted to them, and I was invited to join them, and I did.
Oh, we're a gaggle of grannies, urging you off of your fannies. We're raising our voice. We want a new choice. No more war with all the money they're spent.
I like writing songs. I never wrote songs until I became a granny.
Allison is our chief songwriter, fortunately, because she has a wonderful way with words.
Our songs always have a punch. We don't whine and preach. We try to be very serious in our message, but our way of getting the message across tries to use humor or some way of making it interesting and getting to the public. We can get across to people. And we've had exciting times.
We've always tackled social issues, social security, welfare, gay rights, minimum wage, equal pay for women.
Here's a song the Vancouver Raging Grannies sang to inaugurate a large urban project called Women Transforming Cities.
Where are women in the planning of the cities of our land? Where are our contributions of the things we understand? If we had been included as urban life was built, how would they have been planned?
Yeah, anyone can be a raging granny is our attitude. And when men say, well, can I, you know, what about us? And we say, well, yeah, what about you? What are you doing? Why don't you start your own group? Well, you know, well, can't we horn in on your group? I don't think so, is what we answer. I think you need to, you know, you're not a woman. Now just go get your own group going. Quit riding on our skirts.
There are at least 60 Raging Granny Gaggles across Canada today. Raging Granny Gaggles have also emerged in Australia, Japan, Greece, Israel, the United Kingdom, and across the U.S. For more information about the Raging Grannies, visit their website www.raginggrannies.org or just do a web search for Raging Grannies.
So we'll bitch, rage, and roar even more until corporate greed takes a fall.
This story is based on the program Raging Grannies, produced by Jana Juniper G and Frieda Worden for Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. For Groundwire, I'm Jen LaFranc.
Canada is famous around the world for its involvement in mining, but our country is also infamous for the same thing. So much so that a day of action was targeted just at Canadian mining operations. Here's more.
On August 1st, people across the Americas came out to demonstrate during the Continental Day of Action against Canadian mega-resource extraction. Out of 37 locations, 10 were in Canada. Melanie Schambach explains why it was important to her to demonstrate in Vancouver.
There are around 950, almost to 1,000 mining companies based in BC, most of them in Vancouver. So when you look up to the high rises of all the buildings in downtown, most of what you're seeing are mining offices. It's pretty incredible. So really get into understanding the power that Vancouver has in worldwide mining. We wanted to participate in this Continental Day of Action, putting out a memorial in memory of all those brave people that have opposed to Canadian mining and that have been assassinated, public demands on some of the violence that has happened. I mean, there's been many brave folks that have been assassinated in the past 2 or 3 years that have been opposing to specific Canadian mining. So we had in the area, we had photos addressing the different stories on how they are affected by Canadian mining. And prior to the memorial, we went to 4 different companies and delivered in person a letter each place.
One of the examples Schambach gave of human rights violations took place in Marimata, Colombia. Since 1946, the region has been reserved for small local mining operations. But after 2007, the government turned it over to Toronto-based Gran Torino Gold. The company is trying to remove the town in order to strip mine the area. Melanie Schambach.
They first steal the mine from the workers who owned it, and then 70 workers of that mine stand on strike, then security guards open fire, and then the company calls the workers terrorists. So after this, the union leaders Hamilton Ariana Maya and Nelson Caravib appear on television on July 25th and denounce the mass firings that happened, and then 2 days later they were shot. In Colombia as well, last September, this was the same company, Gran Colombia. Father José Reynel Restrepo, he's a priest, he was assassinated on September 1st, and this was 3 days after he spoke out publicly against the mining plant in Marmato, that is under Marmato, where there's thousands of people, and the plan is to remove the whole town so they can dig on the mine, and that is still in process. Just other and this just go on and on. There's Mariano Abarca Rulero, a Mayan farmer who opposed to the Calgary-based Black Fire Corps Mario mining Chiapas in Mexico. He was assassinated in 2009, and the former Black Fire employees have been charged with murder. The native activist Jeronimo Rodriguez Tugri opened it to Vancouver-based Petaquilla Minerals. It's a mine that is being proposed in North Bay Bugle territories, and he was one of two protesters that were killed by Panamanian security forces, and this was early this year in February 2012. Also, Dora Sortorresinos, opponent of Vancouver-based Pacific Rim's mining plans to build a gold mine in El Salvador, Cabañas province. She died after being shot 5 times in the back while she was carrying her 2-year-old child in December 2009.
There are many similar stories of murders related to Canadian mining across the world. Nati Garcia is an indigenous Guatemalan Mayan raised in Vancouver. For her, the human rights violations around Canadian mining feel very personal.
And I still get shaky about it when I talk about it at times. And just as it was mentioned previously, when I just heard Mel talking about the amount of lives that have been sacrificed over these projects and the profit that is put into it as well, and the support that it has, and the lack of like awareness in regards to these deaths. If you go on the streets of downtown right now and you go around Burrard Street and you ask every person that walks by if they know this person who has been murdered because of them speaking up for what Goldcorp has been doing or any other mining company, the work they have been doing on their land, majority of them wouldn't know who that person is. And I think that's what hurts me the most, the fact that nobody knows and recognizes the lives that have been taken.
Lives have been taken not only by assassination and by removing people from their homelands, but also by pollution. In Vancouver, on the Continental Day of Action Against Canadian Mega Resource Extraction, demonstrators hand-delivered letters to 4 mining offices. The letter given to Goldcorp protested the company's severe pollution of the only source of drinking water around the Marlin mine in San Marcos, Guatemala. For more information about mines and human rights, search for Mining Justice online. I'm Frida Worden. Thanks also to Richard Vickery. We're reporting for Groundwire.
Mining justice advocates are placing hopes on Federal Bill C-323, the International Promotion and Protection of Human Rights Act introduced by NDP MP Peter Julian. This bill would allow foreign citizens to pursue lawsuits in Canadian courts for human rights violations committed by persons operating outside Canada. A related bill, C-300, was defeated in Parliament in 2010. It would have given the government authority to investigate complaints against resource companies operating abroad and to withhold public money from offenders. In May, as a part of the budget bill, the federal government weakened the Fisheries Act. It no longer commands the protection of all fish habitat, but only habitats affecting economically viable fish species. Jay Peachy is an artist and advocate on behalf of wild salmon. On August 11th, he organized the Burrard Inlet Fish Fest in Port Moody, BC, to celebrate the aquatic ecosystem. Nick Panu reports for Groundwire.
I'm Henry Charles. I come from the Musqueam Nation. I'd like to welcome everybody to the traditional territories of the Musqueam people. And I said, you're all good people for being here today to help to save the Salmon Foundation. So thank you all, and we'll enjoy the festival.
There's actually a river coming right through that station. All these waterways were connected at one time.
They were all connected at one time. We understand that they went towards the village of Sanok.
In the wild salmon here in BC is becoming an endangered species. You know, how important is it in the food chain? How important was it then?
That was our basic diet of the Aboriginal people in this area, or what they call us First Nations now. And if you go back and you look at the history of the salmon, that it basically fertilized all the plant life, the lives in the areas surrounding the fishing areas of our villages, right? The bear took all the salmon out of the water beside the creeks and the waterways that it was produced, the great growth of forest and land, and everything was produced by the salmon. And plus, we used the salmon like the oils and that. When we sun-dried it, we wind-dried it, We stored it for our winter provisions, and we made connections of how the Creator let us have it, and we used it like the salmon oils for some of our medicines.
And here we are, a little somber. Segueing into this topic is 2012, and the wild salmon runs are fortunately not as prevalent. We're here right in Burrard Inlet, and the runs, there aren't that many salmon out there right now, the wild salmon.
There's not very many salmon runs left around because of the pollution and the overdevelopment. I said, but where I come from, we have a creek called Muscombe Creek, and as we were growing up, it was called Tin Can Creek. That is the last surviving salmon run in Vancouver. The salmon there are a very, very endangered species. And the sea lice from the fish farms aren't helping anything at all, right? And it said, with the sea lice and everything infecting our wild salmon, have you looked at any of the photographs? They're cancerous and they're deformed. And you can't feed a human being that thing. The Creator gave us the salmon.
What a pleasure it is to be standing here with Oz 12. How are you doing? And thank you for still taking the time to do another interview.
It's good. Happy to be here at Fish Fest.
How important was it for you personally to be here at this festival and perform?
For me, it's very important to come to Fish Fest because my people have lived in this area forever. I'm a Coast Salish Stalo member. Also, my family's just from Coquitlam over here. Coquitlam is actually my grandfather's name. That's pretty important. And our people have always sustained our lives with salmon and seafood. And the environment is very important to us. So to come and raise awareness with music and be able to play music on stage for people, to me, is awesome. I can't imagine a world without salmon. And we already had a year where we didn't catch any. And that's crazy. I used to be able to just be like, hey, can I have a fish? And my cousins woke it up, but now it's not like that.
How important is it for people, you know, this is going to create a lot of awareness, but for maybe people to try and make a conscious effort to do something, to create more awareness for this?
Yeah, I mean, everybody needs to kind of educate themselves more. To some people, it seems far-fetched to try to save the environment, but everybody should just do what they can to raise awareness and hopefully not let corporations step in and pollute the environment more than it needs to be. People need to understand their connection to their food and their food's connection to the environment. Without the environment, you don't have food, and you end up eating processed corn and these things that just aren't healthy for you. You know, as Indigenous people, we're supposed to eat salmon. If we don't, we get sick. It's very well studied and documented. So if I don't have salmon, that affects my life. Like, I need to eat it. We need to teach the kids from when they're very young the importance of the preservation of the environment and their connections to food and how it relates to their health. And they need to understand that at a young age. Education system needs to step up to that. And, you know, media sources need to step up to that. And, you know, it's our job just to, we should teach the youth so that they, you know. My cousin has a saying. He says that we plant trees now so our children can enjoy the shade. Right? So we have to think about the future and not now. Because as long as we make things easier for ourselves and we live within fear and comfort for ourselves, then we're just going to wreck everything, and then the kids are going to inherit something that's going to be really horrible.
Our last feature, as always, is the station report, covering activities of one or more of the campus and community radio stations in Canada. This time it's about a kids' radio camp at CJSF-FM. Megan Jeffrey reports.
This year, as in the past several years, CJSF, Simon Fraser University's campus and community radio station, gave the opportunity to a group of 10 excited and creative kids to try their hand at radio.
Hi, I'm Erica.
I'm Tanya.
And I'm Yuli.
And this is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby.
Woo! Woo! So, first, our week at radio camp.
First, on Monday, we played different games and learned each other's names.
On Tuesday, we went to the radio station, Co-op 100.5 FM, and interviewed Leela.
My name is Leela, and I am the Director of Programming Administration at Co-op Radio, which is CFRO 102.7 FM.
What do you do here?
It's a good question. because there's a lot to do at a radio station to keep it running. And different radio stations work differently. At Co-op Radio, we have four different staff who work in four different areas in the station, and then we all work together to manage the station. Mm-hmm. So I'm part of that collective, that group of people that manages the station. And then for me, I focus on the areas of training and programming. So I work with a committee, it's called a programming committee, and we're a group of people that makes decisions about the shows that come on the air, which shows we want to accept, which shows might not be on the air anymore, which time slots, which shows go in which time slots, and those kinds of decisions. And then we organize training to make sure everybody knows how to do the radio and they feel they've got the skills to do it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
On Wednesday, we learned about salmon and painted pictures. Then we walked down to the Pocket Market and interviewed Sweet Tia, Bread Affair, Nature's Garden, and Pocket Market Farms.
Just to clarify, by pocket market, what Tanya means is pocket farmers market, which is an initiative put on by Sustainable SFU, the environmental-based organization, on a weekly basis, and the businesses that they interview take part of the market regularly.
Here's our interview with Sweet Tia.
Hello, girls.
Hi, what's your name?
Oh, my name is Christina.
What interested you in working here?
Oh, I like coffee and cakes. So I just like the whole atmosphere working at markets, and I like to work with cakes.
Thank you for your time.
So on Friday, well, we had an ice cream party, and now we're on the radio.
With you guys!
Woo!
In addition to learning about interviewing skills, the kids also got the opportunity to delve into other radio feats, such as sports reporting.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and my DJ name is Radio Rebel. And sadly for the Olympics, one of my favorite sports and one of my others, one of them is equestrian, and Tiffany, her horse just got a teeny tiny scratch. She got disqualified no matter what. And I do horseback riding myself. And then on swimming, another of my favorite sports, there was one swimmer that got 0.0 points that did a belly flop. He was doing a flip in midair. Then he kind of lost his balance in the midair. Then he kind of accidentally did a belly flop, so he got 0 points.
This year, our camp was also gifted with the presence of a budding news journalist.
Hello, DJ Sirius here. I'm going to be talking about the news. Burnaby's Christine Sinclair returns home with a bronze. She was on the Canadian women's soccer team at the London Olympics. Now, in transit, police will start giving advance warnings of where they will set up enforcement blitz to nab transit fare cheaters. Spokesperson Anne Duranan said public notice of fare checks through the media, on the web, and via Twitter will begin in September as TransLink intensifies its efforts to combat fare cheating and make those who are caught pay their fines.
And what radio camp or program would be complete without a little bit of comedy?
Granville and all the superheroes were too old to fight. But then came a new super improved, super-powered superhero, Chicken Man, and is still the most victorious superhero of all time.
Reporting from Kids Camp for CJSF in Burnaby, this has been Megan Jeffrey.
That's the end of our Groundwire program for today. Thanks to everyone who helped with the show.
Groundwire is produced by various stations that are members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association of Canada. If your station would like to produce an episode, please email groundwireprod@gmail.com. Each episode also includes contributions from many people. If you have a story to report, also email groundwireprod@gmail.com.